This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day. During the coming hour, we'll be talking about the presidential campaign, candidate strategies, who's calling who what, and is it sticking? Commentary from political scientist Donna Hoffman and Tim Hagel, along with Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters, after watching President Obama campaigning Tuesday in Cedar Rapids. And we'll be inviting your comments, too. River to River Politics Day, right after the NPR News. Dean Borg continuing River to River on this Politics Day. And the first part of the program, we're going to be hearing and analyzing a little bit about President Obama's visit to Cedar Rapids yesterday. Our Iowa Public Radio reporter Clay Masters covered that event. Clay, hello.
Hi, Dean.
And we're going to be hearing from Clay in just a minute, but I want to invite in Donna Hoffman, who is in our University of Northern Iowa studios in Cedar Falls. Professor Hoffman.
Hello, Dean.
She is a chair of political science at the UNI. And Tim Hagel's with us in the studio in Iowa City. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim?
Hey there.
Hi. I'm going to go back, and I want you, Donna and Tim, to ask Clay about the visit yesterday, if there's some questions that arise in your minds. But I want him now just to kind of tell us the ambiance and the characteristics of the crowd that you saw. How many hours did you spend up there?
I was there for about a couple hours, spent a lot of time writing. But the time that I did spend with those in the audience, there was a pretty strong middle-class group of people there.
How could you tell they were middle-class?
How could I tell? Well, about the dozen or so folks that I spoke with, people that worked for the Electricians Union, there were some tech writers, students. So it was a pretty good mix of middle-class folks.
And age demographics?
It ran the gamut. I mean, there were some younger students there up to some retired people as well.
Mm-hmm. And those tickets were free, and so anybody could come. I think they were in a downtown office there that they were invited to go get those tickets, so they weren't passed out only to Democratic activists.
That's correct. Yeah. And most of the people there were – I asked them if they were there to try to get a better perspective of who they wanted to vote for in the election. And almost everybody in the dozen so folks that I talked with, they were all decided that they were going to be voting to reelect the president.
Mm-hmm. Was the ambiance as – and I've attended many, covered many of these events. In fact, covered the first one. In fact, Obama was in Cedar Rapids opening his campaign 4 years ago. And so he was back in the same spot where he opened the campaign, hoping to recreate and ignite that exuberance. Did you see a whole lot of that? Are you fired up? Excitement?
Well, yeah, and he started the speech off with bringing up nostalgia. I mean, he was talking about when he was first there in 2008 and talking about how, you know, this is where I started it, right here in Cedar Rapids. So he was really trying to rally that support, that energy that he fought for in 2008. And I expected the crowd to be a little more lukewarm than I remembered the 2008 stuff. And he just – there was a lot of shouting. There was a lot of applause. There was a lot of excitement in that audience.
So he's still able to ignite it, Tim Hagel. He's still able to ignite that crowd as he did 4 years ago, because there's been some question about, you know, people aren't quite as excited about his candidacy this time.
Well, I would expect that a crowd that comes out to see a candidate, whether it's President Obama or Governor Romney, that they're generally going to be in favor of that particular candidate, because you often don't take time off work or take the time out of your day to spend for somebody that you're just not sure about. Now, some people
after all, he is the president, though. You're seeing the president. You're not seeing just a candidate.
That's true. You are seeing the president. Some people will go for that particular reason. But I think in general, though, somebody that's an incumbent is going to be in a little bit tougher shape, because, of course, you've got to run on a record, unlike 4 years ago where that was that potential historic nomination. And so the question is how close can the Obama campaign get to that enthusiasm of 2008? I don't think they're going to get there, but they need more than what Democrats had, say, in 2010.
I will say there was one person that I talked to that said that he was debating between the president and if Ron Paul ran as a third party, he'd vote for him.
There you go.
How do you rationalize that? I mean, that's quite a spectrum. If I don't vote for President Obama, and if Ron Paul were on the ballot, I'd vote for him?
Well, it's not really, because the Ron Paul folks, libertarians in general, tend to be more liberal on the social issues, more conservative on the fiscal issues. And so if for a particular voter, if they're leaning more towards the social side of things rather than the fiscal, you can see that, you know, if Ron Paul, their preferred choice, isn't going to run as a third party candidate and they don't like Governor Johnson, who's probably going to get that nomination, then they would go on the social side with Obama rather than Romney.
Donna?
I'd be interested in asking Clay. I heard reports that there was an overflow crowd outside, and if he has any estimates of that particular crowd, I understand the estimates of the people inside the venue were about 1,600.
Yeah, I didn't spend much time. I was shuttled in at the beginning and shuttled out at the end, so most of my time was spent inside. So I didn't get a good view of who all was there once I got out there.
I'd like to ask, too, about the demographics, gender division there. Pretty much men and women, and were there any direct appeals to the female vote?
There wasn't. I mean, there were some, if I remember right, there were some mentions to the women vote when he was discussing health care. But for the most part, it was appealing to a general audience. And one thing that I thought was really interesting was going into this, I was reading lots that he was going to focus a lot on his decision for the tax plan that he unveiled earlier this week. But the president spent a lot of time talking about the economy and took pains to illustrate the difference in philosophy between himself and presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney. We'll hear a little bit of that.
My opponent, his allies in Congress, they sincerely believe that prosperity comes from the top down. They believe that if we spend trillions of dollars more on tax cuts, mostly for the wealthy, that it'll somehow create more jobs. Even if we have to pay for it by gutting education, shopping assistance, community colleges or Pell Grants, cutting back on training, raising middle-class taxes. They believe that if we roll back regulations that we put in place on banks and insurance companies and oil companies, all meant to protect our people and our economy, that somehow everybody's going to be better off. And I think they're wrong. You know, I think they're wrong. And listen, it's not just my opinion. We tried it their way through most of the last decade, and it didn't work.
Well, Donna and Tim, you heard, and I'm sure you've heard other clips, but there was a pretty good sampling right there of the interchange, Donna, between the president and the crowd.
Yeah, he took a kind of a much more conversational tone in portions of the speech, especially. And one of the things that he did that I think was fairly effective when I heard the whole speech is that he took, you know, pains to identify with or to at least try to identify with the people in the audience. One of the things that he talked about was, I remember when Michelle and I sat down and we had to pay the bills and we had a mortgage and we had, you know, car payment and these kinds of things. And, you know, he's going to do more of that because while he didn't implicitly say Romney has never had to do those things, I think that's eventually what the campaign is trying to, you know, put in the minds of voters. And if you listen to Vice President Biden out on the trail, Biden's much more explicit about that. And about the drawing the differences between Romney and the president in terms of their backgrounds and in terms of identifying with average voters. So, you know, Obama adopted this kind of conversational tone a little more and really kind of went to great pains to say, you know, really, I am one of you. And I appreciate Iowa. And Iowa gave one of the things that he said that's been reported a lot. Iowa gave me a chance when no one else would. And so he really, I think, went to lengths to try to identify with the people there in the audience.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Donna, because we want to be talking later in our conversation here about middle-class politics and that strategy. And at that point, too, I'd like to ask our listeners, What do you think of the two presidential candidates appealing to middle-class voters? And do you consider yourself a member of the middle class? So give us a call, and we'll invite you into the conversation later here. It's 866-780-9100. We're talking middle class and the appeal that both candidates are trying to make to that middle class. Tim?
You know, one thing, oh, and let me just say as an aside, Donna, you'd asked about the overflow crowd. I'd seen a report that it was about 500 in addition to the folks that were there. Let me ask this of Clay. One of the things I noticed in watching the speech on TV was that you had, in terms of President Obama's interactions with the audience, there were a few people that were shouting out things on a regular basis. And although he's used to the I love you back exchange, which he gets in almost every speech, it seemed to happen a lot more. And at least watching on television, it seemed to throw him off stride. What was your impression being there?
Yeah, there was one woman that was standing pretty close to the press pool who had a very loud voice and was able to get her thoughts up to the president. And it was. I was noticing him trying to catch on to it to see if there was something he could, you know, launch into one of his campaign thoughts. And one time she shouted out something about veterans, and he was able to go down a tangent there. But there were a few times where the eyes drifted away from the teleprompter, and there was a little bit of confusion, I think, in the president's face.
You know, that gets back to the point that you raised there to something Republicans have chided the president about from time to time, and that is using a teleprompter so as not to misspeak. Now, part of that is being the president, and you very carefully have to measure those words. But also, if it threw him just a bit, being off teleprompter, that undergirds that argument.
Yeah, it's possible to rely a little bit too much on it, but Obama has always done a very good job in terms of reading that. And in fact, today as I was watching Governor Romney's speech before the NAACP convention, one of the first tweets that I did was saying that he needs to be a little more polished because he wasn't as smooth moving from one screen to the other as Obama is.
We're talking about the middle class. Dave is calling in from Urbandale with an invitation. Dave, what do you have to say about the middle class?
Good morning. I consider myself middle class.
Why?
I'm retired. I'm on a fixed income. And my entire life has been middle class. But when
What do you consider the middle class?
What I consider the middle class, that's people with reasonable education, with reasonable job experience, not outside the bounds of $500,000 a year or living in $2 or $3 million homes. I think middle class is representative of a community like mine in Urbandale where the average home is $200,000 or less. That's what I, and living within the means of that.
Dave, thanks for giving us that perspective. And I would ask you then, Tim, knowing what Dave just said in that call from Urbandale, is this resonating in the campaign, both candidates trying to appeal to that middle class? Good strategy?
Well, it's a good strategy to the extent that that's where the people are. That, you know, obviously you're not going to appeal necessarily to just rich folks, anybody making, you know, over 250,000 or over a million or whatever figure you want to pick, because there just aren't that many people there. I did happen to notice yesterday, and I can't recall which speech it was that President Obama was giving, if it was in Cedar Rapids or something later, where he was trying to expand the middle class and expand his talk about that to include, you know, people don't like to use the phrase lower class or generally poor folks, but basically trying to say anybody who doesn't fit into that top 2% or whatever it is. So he's sort of expanding that definition, saying, here, I'm helping all of you folks, which, of course, is going to be the vast majority of voters.
Elise is calling from Iowa City. Also wants to comment about that middle class. Elise?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling from Iowa City, and I recently became unemployed as of June 30th. I was very solidly in the middle class up until then. I directed federal grants, federally funded grants, for the last 11 years. 3 years ago, I was seeing what was happening with Congress defunding the federal education program and started applying for other jobs. I've been unable to secure alternative employment, and employment, I should say. And at this point, I'm not able to afford COBRA payments for health insurance for my family. And am just sort of desperately hoping that I can secure work in the next few weeks. I am terrified of a Republican Congress and a Republican president coming into office because there's absolutely nothing in their platform that gives me any hope for my family's future security or to recover our position in a middle class, income, benefits, et cetera. So you asked, as people in the middle class, what our take on the – I am no longer in the middle class, and it's largely because of Republican policies that I'm no longer in the middle class, and I have no hope of regaining that footing if we have Republicans in power.
So the president's rhetoric is resonating with you.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Elise, for calling. Well, Tim, you've heard about the perspective there of a person who thinks that she has fallen, was in the middle class, has fallen out of the middle class. How does Governor Romney counter something like that?
Well, I think that Romney and the Republicans would generally say that the problem is getting somebody like Elise or other folks who have recently lost their jobs or maybe not so recently lost a job and are still looking for work, find them jobs. And their argument is that the proposals that President Obama has made will hurt the economy in terms of job creation. Of course, President Obama and part of his speech yesterday suggested otherwise.
And Donna, what challenges particularly does this present for Governor Romney as a successful business person who can't identify with the wage earners? That's being exploited against him.
That's part of the way Obama and his campaign want to draw distinctions between the two candidates here. And so, they're trying to paint him as out of touch, as being, I think Obama would tell you Romney's been a success at what he's done. Earlier, when there was a little more discussion of the Bain Capital record, the Romney people wanted to, show that he was a successful businessman. He's running on that record rather than his record in Massachusetts. And the Obama people have gone to great strides to show that he was in charge of making a profit at Bain. And that's different than being president. And that's one of the points that the campaign earlier at least was trying to hammer home. And I think they'll eventually, and they haven't totally left that, but I think they'll come back to that a little bit more. Because, Elise gets at this this notion in the middle class in the aftermath of the Great Recession, if you will, that there's this precariousness that you're, a pink slip away from being destitute or, on the path to that. And there's that uncertainty with economic conditions across the country that makes this particular discussion about who is middle class, what does that mean, who will best help the middle class, really relevant for this particular election.
And, of course, that morphs into the other strategy in this campaign, and that is the Bush tax cuts and the coming expiration of that. Clay, that was mentioned yesterday, too.
Yeah, he did spend a fair amount of time talking about that, saying that folks like himself or Warren Buffett or Mitt Romney can afford to pay those taxes. So he's calling for that renewal of the Bush-era tax cuts for those making less than $250,000 a year, but letting those cuts expire for those who make more than $250,000. And he previewed the coming battle in Congress over the plan.
Doesn't it make sense for us to agree to keep taxes low for 98% of Americans who are working hard and can't afford a tax hike right now? I mean, think about it. I want to hold taxes steady for 98% of Americans. Republicans say they want to do the same thing. We disagree on the other 2%. Well, what do you usually do if you agree on 98% and you disagree on 2%? Why don't you compromise to help the middle class? Go ahead and do the 98%, and we can keep arguing about the 2%. Let's agree when we can agree.
And Donna, of course, if you're that 98 and 2% also resonates with 98% of the voters and 2% who don't have that much power at the voting box.
You know, that's obviously the appeal the campaign's getting to that. But, you know, one of the things we know about the American public is that the American dream, that notion is very strong there. And a lot of people who are in the middle class feel like someday they can be in the upper class. And so that can present you with some problems there. But another interesting thing about what Obama was talking about there in terms of this compromise that potentially might come out of Congress is that, you know, the compromise could be, and there's already been some discussion of this, that because in the Senate you have some Democratic senators who are in tough re-election races, that might get pushed up, that $250,000 figure, to letting the rates stay or expire on maybe those making $1 million or more. And so you might even see some compromise in terms of, is it the 2% or the $250,000 wage earners or the people over $1 million?
And of course, what will influence voters is what is said on the campaign trail. And the Congressional Budget Office, though, has published an analysis. The Washington Times carried it earlier this week. Wealthy Americans earn about 50% of all income, according to the report. But now this, 50% of all income, but they pay nearly 70% of the federal tax burden, according to that latest analysis by the Congressional Budget Office. And the CBO looked at the years 2007 through 2009 and found that the bottom, now we're looking at the lower end of the economic strata, the bottom 20% of American earners paid just 0.3% of the total tax burden, but the richest paid 20%, or the rich, I should say, the richest 20% now paid 67% of the taxes. In other words, the richest 20% paid 67% of the taxes, and the bottom 20% of American earners paying just 0.3% of the total tax burden. But that's not, those aren't statistics you'll hear on the campaign trail.
Well, you won't hear them from President Obama. You will tend to hear them from Republicans, maybe not Romney specifically, but I know that I've heard those variations of those statistics for quite some time. The response, and even in the Cedar Rapids speech yesterday, President Obama talks about those who can afford more, and that's sort of the distinction. So it's the idea that, well, maybe the people that are in the lower income groups aren't paying a lot of taxes, but that's because they can't afford to, and the rich people can afford to. And so that's the way that they try to, without mentioning the statistics, sort of give a counter argument to them.
Donna, I was asking Clay earlier, what was the ambiance there? Were people just as excited as I had seen them 4 years ago about the Obama candidacy? And that poses a question to you, as with repeated visits by top-level administration officials and also the Romney campaign, but the president being in Iowa so much, does the significance of a presidential visit wear off a little bit?
You know, that's kind of an interesting question, because I am not a native Iowan. And when I arrived in Iowa and I would talk to my students, I would, you know, excoriate them to go see these candidates and in fact, the president who comes to Iowa. And they in fact, even before this, were a little bit blasé, because you do see presidential candidates quite a bit. But, you know, for I think the one of the purposes the Obama campaign is trying to achieve with repeated visits to Iowa, besides just the obvious Iowa's important, is that enthusiasm level. They've sunk a lot of money into the ground game in Iowa, and getting people to walk neighborhoods and to get people to do absentee ballots, getting those campaign workers excited, and that these events help that.
That's right. Stirs up the base. Thank you, Clay Masters, for giving us an insight there, and we're going to be continuing this conversation right after the news. This is Iowa Public Radio, River to River. Dean Borg continuing River to River on this Wednesday Politics Day, and with me, Donna Hoffman, UNI Chair of Political Science. She's in our studio in Cedar Falls. Tim Hagel's with me in the studio in Iowa City. He's an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. And Tim, Donna, just before we listened to the news, was talking about the possible diminishing returns of repeated presidential visits. What about coming to eastern Iowa so often?
Well, as far as the diminishing returns. One of the things that I was thinking about is what we saw a little bit in the 2004 campaign, where President Bush came to Iowa many, many times, as did Kerry, that it seemed like at a certain point it was becoming more and more difficult to get people to turn out. And, of course, they were focusing on Iowa as a swing state, just as they're going to in this campaign as well. But at a certain point, the people that have seen him, and even the supporters become a little bit weary of repeated visits. And so they have to kind of pace themselves. And that's one of the things I was concerned about this year with the campaigns, is that they were starting even more early, and it's probably going to get even more intense when we get past Labor Day.
Well, having been a part of many of these, also, you may be running out of people, yes. And part of the reason is that it isn't just a matter of showing up 15 minutes before the president speaks. Those people are there hours ahead of time, standing on their feet because of the need to get the Secret Service once also to go through an airport-like security to even get in there. And then most of them are standing maybe for 3 to 4 hours.
And if you have very large events, they're usually outside.
Yes.
The campaigns will generally try to make accommodations for folks that can't stand for that long. But you do have to be pretty much set an hour before the president can actually come into a room, because, as you say, Secret Service has to go through its security check. And if you're waiting in line beforehand to get in because there isn't sort of reserved seating, which there isn't at a lot of these big rallies, then it can be a very long time, very tiring. And so it's good if you're younger. Some of us getting a little older, it's like, well, I don't know if I want to stand for hours at a time.
Donna, I wouldn't blame people in Sioux City by saying, hey, why always in the eastern side of the state? We vote, too.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at the demographics of the state of Iowa, there's a little bit more fertile ground for the Obama campaign on the eastern side of the state. There's a little bit more manufacturing in this area, too, and he's, you know, visited some of the manufacturers on some of his visits as well. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, I'm sure Obama will be back before November. I'm sure he'll be back multiple times. The question now becomes where will he go and which cities will he go to? He's been to Des Moines now, you know, most recently, and now Cedar Rapids. What other places will he go to? And you know, I would still put money on him coming to the eastern part of the state over the western part. But he could still, you know, do some surprises. And you know, he did win the Eastern District of Nebraska in the Electoral College in 2008. And so there are supporters in that area and even in the western part of the state. So he may throw in a visit there, too.
If you want to get involved in the conversation about where the president visits in Iowa or anything else about the conversation today on politics, 866-780-9100. Don, I'll ask you, too, as we were talking about the Bush tax cuts and the looming expiration of those tax cuts, the president would like to let them expire for those earning more than $250,000 a year. Talking about the middle class and tax cuts, is that the ceiling of the middle class?
You know, that's a good question, because no one really agrees on how to define the middle class. Different sociologists do it one way, economists do it a different way. And you know, you can just rely on people saying, I think I'm a member of the middle class. And that's what some people do as well. But, you know, even when you do that, we know that Americans overreport being in the middle class. So some people will think they're firmly in the middle class, and they, in fact, might, by most definitions, not be in the middle class. But yet we are such a country, and it's in such a middle-class democracy that lots of people will say, oh, yeah, I'm a member of the middle class, even if, in fact, they aren't. So it's, you know, it's interesting, this notion of the middle class and its appeal to it, because there's different definitions of what that means, and some people place themselves there and they're actually not in the middle class. And so when you're going to appeal to the middle class as a politician, you have to gauge really not the textbook definition, to the extent that there is one with the middle class, but really that aspirational definition.
Tim?
One of the things that I'm kind of glad to tell the story, given that today's date is 7-Eleven, I used to work at a 7-Eleven store before grad school. And one of the things that struck me was that the people that owned the franchise, that you would probably think that they were fairly well off. I don't know what their income was, but they had a couple of stores of that sort. And so they were pulling in probably what would be considered rich under Obama's definition, but they really weren't or didn't feel they were, because they had mortgages, they had to pay for the buildings, they had expenses and so forth. And so they were doing well, but they certainly didn't consider themselves rich by these types of definitions. And as Chuck Schumer in New York, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, Democrat, has argued is he'd rather see the value up to around $1 million because we're in a state like New York where you have a high cost of living. You know, if you've got kids in college, you've got maybe a mortgage that's underwater, meaning you owe more on it than it's worth, that $250,000 all of a sudden doesn't seem like that much, even though for those of us in Iowa, I saw a figure in the Des Moines Register that said that 99.2% of us, so only 0.8% of us would still have to pay the tax. But, you know, there are a lot of places where $250,000 does not reach by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. I cited some statistics earlier from the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, and here are some others. The CBO says making the Bush tax cut permanent, that is, doing nothing, keeping what we've got right now and extending those and making them permanent, would raise, because it's not raising that revenue that would be coming in if you let the tax cuts expire and raise income taxes then, making the Bush tax cuts permanent would raise deficits by $2.8 trillion over the next 10 years. That's according to the CBO, because they're just not getting that much revenue. Tuesday, here in Iowa, President Obama argued that allowing the tax cuts above the income level of $250,000 to expire would raise, it would, you know, bring in that additional revenue from the richer people, would raise almost $1 trillion over the next decade. But that is only, CBO says, compared with Romney's approach. The Obama plan would add nearly $2 trillion in deficits when compared to doing nothing and allowing the tax cuts to expire. So a lot of things to consider there, Tim.
Well, that's one of the problems is you hear, and President Obama has mentioned this $1 trillion figure, and he does mention that it's over 10 years, but of course the extension is only for 1 year. And so it's playing a little bit loose with what's going on here. And they always talk about 10-year projections, but once you get out more than a few years, it's all pretty fuzzy. I think that also the Republicans, at least, would argue that by imposing those taxes on the job creators, and President Obama has said that this isn't really what happens, but the Republicans argue that by imposing a tax on the job creators, that it, in fact, makes it worse for the economy.
Rick is on the line from Iowa City. Hi. Go ahead, Rick.
Morning. Well, I guess afternoon.
We're
this
doing
may
well.
Become outrage, but I was wondering, with the $250,000 limit, if a person makes $261,000, do they just pay the higher tax on the $11,000 or on the entire $261,000? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Rick, for calling. And I'm not sure that we have CPAs here as guests
well,
today.
Well, Dean, I can speak to that a bit.
Good.
We need to remember that we have marginal tax rates. And so when Obama talks about, keeping the Bush tax cuts in place for those earning under $250,000, even for those who are above that, their rate would stay the same on that first $250,000 that they make. It's the marginal rate above that on which the taxes would go back to presumably Clinton-era tax rates.
So in Rick's example, he cited $261,000. It would be the higher tax rate for the $11,000 over the $250,000.
Right, yeah.
Yep, got it. Well, what do you think, Tim, if there's a fight in Congress over where to draw the line on tax cuts, let's say that there is a line drawn, who is hurt or helped in that argument, and how would you expect the battle lines to be there?
Well, you know, it's an odd thing because, like many issues in politics, you're never sure who's going to be helped, who's going to be hurt, that it has a lot to do with the messaging, or if you want to put it a little bit more negatively, the spin.
Yep.
Who can basically sell their argument better to the voters in particular? And since we're coming into a presidential year, that's particularly important. And so it's really a matter of, as you see, the competing messages were, as Obama said, this is a compromise. And I thought that was a good way to sort of turn that into his advantage because people generally like compromise. On the other hand, for the Republicans, they feel that they're standing on principle, that they don't want to engage in, as they call it, class warfare and so forth. So it's a matter of who can basically sell their message in the best way to the voters.
And building on that, Donna, does the Obama income tax proposal that we heard earlier this week, Does that present an opportunity or a dilemma for Republican Mitt Romney?
I think it presents a little bit of a dilemma for him because he obviously wants to extend all of those. And, you know, he may have to this notion of compromise that Tim was talking about. Compromise is really often necessary in American politics, but yet some people who fervently believe certain things will see if you compromise on my issue that I feel most particular about, then you're really selling out on your principles. And so it presents a problem for Romney and congressional Republicans as well, in that if they compromise on that, will voters see that as they're not firm on their principles, or will they interpret that as something that has to be done in order to move things forward? And compromise has been particularly difficult in Washington most recently.
For sure.
And that's particularly true, as Don was saying, for the Republicans, because they have to face, in many instances, Tea Party voters who are getting sick and tired of sending Republicans to Congress who then become big government Republicans as opposed to limited government Republicans. And so if you see them as a Tea Party person, if you see your person that you sent to Congress all of a sudden voting for tax increases, even if it's on the richest folks, it becomes more difficult for them to explain that to voters.
The number to call if you want to get involved in the conversation, and we've been talking here and we will continue talking with Donna Hoffman, who is the University of Northern Iowa Chair of Political Science, and with Tim Hagel, who is a political scientist at the University of Iowa. The number to call is 866-780-9100. How does this, Tim, translate into campaign fundraising? Governor Romney outraised President Obama, the latest report, in June, $106 million for Romney, $71 million for Obama. What does money buy in a campaign? Does it translate only into more commercials?
Well, certainly we're going to see lots and lots of commercials, and it's not just what the individual campaigns are raising, but you have the various interest groups, super PACs, and so forth that are contributing in various ways as well, and they'll have their commercials. But it does more than that. One of the things it does is it provides a structure for the campaign. That I know the Obama campaign has heralded all the number of offices that they've been opening up, and now the Republicans have been opening up offices, one here recently in Coralville this last weekend. So it's getting those folks, and I look at it as hiring my students. So the more money they have in their campaign, they can hire young people usually to become field representatives and be the ones that go out and help the counties mobilize voters. It can provide voter lists. It can provide a variety of things for a campaign, not just the commercials. But, of course, commercials are there, and we see them a lot because they do reach so many people. Direct mail is of course, another one, a version of commercials, I suppose.
Donna, what do you read into the fundraising totals?
Yeah, I would agree with Tim on that in terms of what, you know, that money buys. It will buy an awful lot of television commercials, but it'll help the ground game of the candidates as well. And you know, I would remind listeners that TVs do have off buttons, and you can turn them off. And you can listen to things like Iowa Public Radio, where you don't encounter those kinds of things if you so choose. But especially in Iowa, that ground game has really been important for the Obama campaign, and the Romney campaign is just now, I think, getting into that. But since Iowa is such an important state, there will be a lot of people walking neighborhoods, knocking on doors. And some of those people will be volunteers, but some of them will be paid.
But, Donna, President Obama has an inherent advantage as the incumbent. And so is the fact that he has less in the campaign chest really a determining factor in reaching voters?
Well, you know, that was 1 month of numbers that we heard. And the previous month was not quite the disparity wasn't quite there, although Romney did win that, if you will. But, you know, before that, Obama was thumping Romney, if you will. And that's because at this stage of the campaign, we need to take a long view of this. You know, Romney is now the de facto nominee. In previous months, that was less certain, certainly in March, but in April it was pretty set in May. But, you know, now those people who had sat on their pocketbooks who, you know, were going to give to the Republican nominee eventually, but they just weren't sure, you know, who to give to yet, maybe. Now those funds are going to come out. And so it's really not a surprise at this stage in the game that Romney now is able to consolidate some of that support, and it can translate into more funds. The Obama campaign does have a problem, and they can use this message, I think, to some for some gains potentially to say, look, we're being outspent. And if the numbers, you know, continue in this way for Romney, that's not good for the Obama campaign. And furthermore, you know, we know that there's a huge disparity in the money that's going into the outside spending for the Republicans as well. And that's a challenge for Democrats also.
The super PACs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, two things on that. The first is I'm sure that Obama will pick up his fundraising as time goes on. Maybe, again, not as enthusiastically as what happened 4 years ago, but still the money will come in. And there was an interesting report the other day about the amount of money that unions actually spend, that it's really a lot more than what they directly give to campaigns. And so that helps to offset a lot of the super PACs where money seems to be coming, at least right now, to more to Republicans.
I wasn't going to get into this right at this moment, but you've opened the door, Tim.
Oops.
just here in Iowa, there's sort of a little tussle, more than that, that's a polite word, between the governor and some state employee unions now over health insurance premiums. And just to frame it, the governor a week or so ago by executive order said state employees are now free to contribute if they want to up 20% of our health insurance premiums. And the governor and lieutenant governor and some executive council Republicans said, yeah, we'll do that. But Danny Homan of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and Danny Homan doesn't ever mince any words because he's very contentious in relations with the governor, said, oh, not so fast, governor. I'm filing suit on that because that violates collective bargaining. What's all the political significance during a presidential year, or isn't there any at all?
Well, there's certainly significance. Now, whether it translates at the presidential level, it's hard to say, but certainly it gets folks at the state level pretty exercised, shall
we
say.
Well, you kind of remember Wisconsin.
Exactly. And the thing is that at least the way it used to be was that the people that were in the public sector weren't making as much, and so they had various advantages like having their health care and or premiums paid for them and some other things. But the idea was that they had job security that people in the private sector didn't have. That argument may not be as valid today if you see instances where public sector employees are getting those benefits and being paid more on average than in the private sector. And so that's kind of where the issue lies here.
All right. I'm going to bring Jim on the line from Waterloo. Jim, go ahead.
Yes. My question has to do.
Well, I think we've lost Jim, and I'm sorry about that. We'll bring on Marty then. Marty has a call here from Marty has just disappeared from the screen. So, Jim, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. We lost you for a minute.
My question has to do with why are, with reference to higher incomes for businesses, why aren't creation of jobs tied to tax cuts in the same way that dependents are tied to, you know, credits for individual taxpayers?
Donna, is there any strategy in that?
Well, I mean, certainly the Republicans will tell you that, I mean, that's part of their rhetoric in terms of why we wouldn't increase taxes on those upper income levels is because that's where job creation happens. Democrats don't necessarily frame it that particular way, and even economists will disagree on the benefit of that and where the tipping point is on that.
Thank you, Jim, for that question. Let's go to, just in the final minutes that we have here, the politics of Medicaid, Tim. What's the political significance, even in the presidential campaign, of several states now rejecting expanding Medicaid to more in low-income people, as the federal government is now offering, in fact, saying, we'll pay 90% of it. Just expand your Medicaid eligibility guidelines. Many Republican governors across the nation, Florida is one, Texas is another, Rick Perry, and Governor Branstad here in Iowa saying, don't think so.
Well, the main reason that they're concerned about it is that it's eventually going to cost the states more. And of course, the states, unlike the federal government, usually have to, or not usually, they do have to balance their budgets. And so ultimately, it will be an expansion. And to the extent that more people are covered, that means that the people that are not part of that then have to pay more for premiums and so forth. And just generally, it's they don't see it as a good economic bargain in the long run.
Donna, comment?
I think you have to view the debate right now that's going on about whether Republican governors in particular are going to expand Medicaid, because that's, you know, a future thing that happens with the health care law, in terms of the election year and the politics right now of that. It'll be interesting to see as we go forward if there's pressure put on those governors from other entities within the states to take that money, because it is it could be somewhat attractive.
Yes, and does it have any significance in the presidential race, particularly with Iowa being a swing state?
I think it does, in that it plays into this notion. I mean, you've seen Governor Branstad more recently be much more pointed in his discussion about President Obama, particularly with his visit today or yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so I think it generally just gets into the framework of healthcare being an aspect of the election, and Republican governors saying, but we think this particular aspect is federal overreach. There's too much strings eventually going to be attached to it, that kind of rhetoric.
Well, we've covered the waterfront on this program of River to River. Quite a metaphor there. Thank you, Donna. Donna Hoffman at UNI, Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa.
Thanks, Dean.
Welcome.
River to River, produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Assistance today from Allison Sullivan and Tony Daner. Executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. River to River is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dean Borg, and thanks for joining us today.